All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going to be tackling a case, United States v. Skilling, and this one, oh boy, it's got a lot in it for anyone who's thinking about a career in law, especially if you're, you know, leaning toward that whole white collar crime world, or even if you're just fascinated by how the Constitution plays out in real life,
yeah.
You know, the nitty-gritty procedural stuff.
Yeah, this is a big one for sure. You can't really talk about white-collar crime without at least touching on Enron.
Exactly, exactly. But, and here's the thing, we're not just going to, you know, rehash the whole Enron saga.
Mm-hmm.
We all know, or at least I hope we all know, how that company went down in flames.
Yeah, I mean, it was huge.
Huge, right, like textbook example of corporate greed and deceit and all that.
Right. And the legal battles that came after, I mean, that's where things get really interesting, at least for our purposes, you know?
Absolutely. So what we're going to do today is really try to unpack, to understand the legal arguments, the decisions, the whole shebang that came after Enron imploded.
Right. Like, did Skilling actually get a fair trial with all that media frenzy going on? What does fraud even mean, legally speaking? And then all those, you know, procedural safeguards that are supposed to keep things fair, did they actually work? Those are the kind of questions we're going to dive into.
Okay, so let's set the stage here. We're talking early 2000s, Enron, this, I don't know, behemoth is the word that comes to mind, right?
Mm.
Energy giant, trading powerhouse. I mean, they were on top of the world. Then, boom, 2001 bankruptcy. It wasn't like a slow decline either, right? It was like falling off a cliff.
Yeah, it was sudden and it was messy and it was all tied to these accusations of, well, massive fraud, like systemic fraud coming from the very top with Skilling, the CEO, right in the thick of it.
Right. And the heart of the accusations against Skilling, at least as I understand it, was that he was basically orchestrating this elaborate scheme to, well, to pump up Enron's stock price.
Exactly. I mean, they were accused of basically manipulating their accounting, like cooking the books to hide huge losses to make the company look way healthier than it actually was, all to, you know, deceive investors, keep that stock price high.
And let's not forget, I mean, this is the part that always gets me. Skilling himself, he dumps something like $60 million worth of his own Enron stock right before everything hits the fan. I mean, talk about suspicious timing.
Oh, yeah. That raised a ton of eyebrows for sure. And, you know, when the dust settled, Skilling ended up facing a whole slew of charges. Conspiracy, securities fraud, making false statements, insider trading, the whole nine yards. He was initially convicted on 19 counts.
19 counts. Wow.
Yeah, but here's the interesting thing. He was actually acquitted on 9 other counts, all related to insider trading. So what does that tell us? It tells us the jury wasn't just blindly convicting him on everything. They're actually looking at the evidence, you know, weighing it, making distinctions.
That is interesting. It shows they were actually, you know, thinking critically about each charge.
Right. But even with those acquittals, the punishment was still pretty hefty. Over 24 years in prison, plus a $45 million restitution order. I mean, that's a lot to swallow.
Yeah, no kidding. And I guess that's when Skilling really started to fight back, legally speaking. I mean, his big argument was that he couldn't have possibly gotten a fair trial in Houston. But like, the whole city was reeling from Enron's collapse.
Exactly. His defense team was basically saying, look, the media coverage was so intense, so negative, so pervasive in Houston, where, you know, so many people had lost their jobs, their savings, their livelihoods because of Enron, that it created this atmosphere of prejudice. Like, how could you possibly find 12 impartial jurors in that environment? They were essentially invoking the Sixth Amendment, the right to an impartial jury.
So their argument was, you know, Houston, we have a bias problem.
Pretty much. But the Supreme Court, they didn't buy it.
We didn't. Why not? What was their reasoning?
Well, a few things. First, they looked at the size and diversity of Houston. It's a huge city, right? Millions of people, all different backgrounds, all different walks of life. Statistically speaking, it's less likely that a jury pool that large would be uniformly biased against Skilling.
So they were basically saying, in a city this big, you're bound to find some impartial folks.
Right. And then they pointed to the voir dire process, which in this case was incredibly thorough. Over 100 potential jurors were questioned over several weeks, all with the goal of weeding out anyone who showed even a hint of bias. It was like an ultra intense screening process.
Wow. I mean, that does sound pretty thorough.
Oh, yeah. They weren't messing around. And then the final point, we touched on this earlier. The Supreme Court said, look, he was acquitted on 9 counts. That suggests the jury wasn't just, you know, rubber stamping a guilty verdict. They were listening. They were deliberating. And when the evidence wasn't there, they acquitted. So even with all the media attention, all the public anger, the system seemed to work, at least in terms of finding an impartial jury.
Okay, so the fair trial argument, it didn't fly. But there's this whole other layer to the case, right? This whole thing about the honest services fraud statute, Section 1346. And this is where things get a little, well, a little wonky.
Yeah, Section 1346, it's a bit of a beast. Before the Skilling decision, it was often interpreted really broadly, you know, like it could basically cover any kind of ethical breach, any conflict of interest, any failure of fiduciary duty by, say, a corporate executive, even if there wasn't clear-cut evidence of bribery or kickbacks.
So it was like this catch-all for, I don't know, bad behavior by people in positions of power?
Kind of, yeah. It was a way to go after folks who might have been, you know, shady or unethical, but whose actions didn't necessarily fit neatly into those traditional fraud boxes.
Right, right. So you could be doing something wrong, but not technically illegal wrong, but still wrong enough to get caught by this statute.
Exactly. But then the Supreme Court, in the Skilling case, they said, whoa, hold on, this is way too broad. They basically narrowed it down, said it only applies to cases involving, you know, straight up bribery or kickbacks, like quid pro quo, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of stuff.
Okay, so that's a pretty significant change, like narrowing the scope of what actually qualifies as honest services fraud.
Huge change. And what it means is that prosecutors, they now need hard proof of bribery or kickbacks. They can't just, you know, wave their hands and say, oh, this guy was being unethical. They need concrete evidence of a specific type of illegal exchange.
Gotcha. So in Skilling's case, all that stuff about misleading investors, manipulating stock prices, even though it was definitely considered fraudulent under other laws, it didn't fit into this new, stricter definition of honest services fraud.
Right. And that leads to a really interesting question. If one of his main convictions, the honest services fraud one, was basically invalid, why didn't the whole case just fall apart? You'd think a mistake that big would have, you know, domino effect.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. If the foundation's cracked, the whole structure should come down, right?
Well, not always. And this is where we get into this legal concept called harmless error.
Harmless error. Okay, I'm intrigued. Break it down for me.
Harmless error, it basically means that an appellate court, they can uphold a lower court's decision, even if there were some mistakes made during the trial, as long as those mistakes didn't really affect the final outcome. It's like saying, okay, there was a technical foul, but it didn't change who won the game.
Okay, I'm starting to see where you're going with this. So how did they apply this harmless error idea to Skilling?
Right, so the Supreme Court, they said the honest services fraud instruction was wrong. It was an error. But then the case went back down to the Fifth Circuit, and they had to decide, was this error harmful? And they said, no, it wasn't.
And how did they come to that conclusion?
Their reasoning was Skilling was also convicted of conspiracy to commit securities fraud, which was a separate charge, totally valid, didn't rely on the whole honest services fraud thing at all. So they said the jury's guilty verdict on that conspiracy charge, it could stand on its own two feet, even without the messed up instruction on honest services fraud.
So one leg of the conviction was shaky, but the other leg was strong enough to hold it up.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Exactly. But wait, there's more.
Oh boy, I knew there was more.
Skilling's team, they also threw in some Fifth Amendment arguments. They said the government interfered with his ability to present certain witnesses and that the prosecution didn't disclose all the evidence that might have helped him, you know, violating what's called their Brady obligations.
Right, Brady. Like that whole idea that the prosecution has to turn over anything that could help the defendant, even if it hurts their case.
Exactly.
Okay.
So did the courts buy any of this?
I mean, with all the other twists and turns, I'm almost afraid to ask.
Well, the Fifth Circuit, they shot down the whole substantial interference claim about the witnesses. They said the evidence just didn't back it up. And as for the Brady stuff, it turned out the prosecution had this open file policy. Basically, they gave the defense access to a ton of evidence.
Oh, so they were like, here you go. Have at it.
Pretty much. And the courts, they said, look, that generally satisfies the Brady requirements. Maybe not every single scrap of paper was handed over, but the overall approach was considered kosher.
So no dice on the Fifth Amendment claims either. But now here's something I do remember. Skilling's actual prison sentence, it got changed, right? What was that all about?
You're right. There was this whole issue with how they calculated his sentence initially, something about a pension plan risk enhancement that added a bunch of time. But the Fifth Circuit, they said, nope. That was wrong, and they sent it back for resentencing.
Okay, so a little bit of a sentencing snafu.
Yeah, you could say that. In the end, instead of going through another whole sentencing trial, Skilling and the government, they worked out a deal. He ended up with a reduced sentence, 14 years instead of the original 24, plus a $42 million forfeiture.
So he still did serious time, but considerably less than what he was initially facing.
Right.
Okay, so we've gone through a lot here. Appeals, Supreme Court rulings, sentencing debates. If you're a law student trying to wrap your head around this whole Skilling saga, what are the key takeaways? What should we be paying attention to?
Well, I'd say there are a few big ones. First off, the Skilling case, it really clarified, like drew a bright line around the whole honest services fraud thing. Now, prosecutors know they need that clear evidence of bribery or kickbacks, no more gray areas.
So win for clarity, at least in terms of that specific statute.
Definitely. And then there's the whole voir dire process. Skilling's case, it really highlights how crucial that is. Even in a case with this much media attention, this much public scrutiny, you can still, with a thorough voir dire, find an impartial jury. The fact that they acquitted him on some counts, that's proof.
Right. It shows that careful jury selection, it can actually work.
Absolutely. And lastly, we've got the whole harmless error doctrine. What the Skilling case shows us is that even if a mistake happens during a trial, a legal error, it's not an automatic game over. If there are other valid reasons for the conviction can stand.
So a little bit of wiggle room, but only if the other reasons are rock solid.
Exactly.
Well, this has been a really deep dive, and I think we've covered a lot of ground here. United States v. Skilling, it's a landmark case, no doubt about it. It changed how we think about honest services fraud. It reaffirmed the importance of those core constitutional protections. And it showed us how the system, even when it's under immense pressure, can still function.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Thanks for joining us on this one, folks. Now, as you're thinking about all this, here's a question for you. Given how the Supreme Court narrowed down that honest services fraud statute, how do you think that's going to affect how prosecutors go after corporate corruption in the future? Will it make it harder to hold those executives accountable? I mean, that's something to think about, right? Anyway, that's all for today. Catch you on the next deep dive.